In the months after the invasion of Iraq, Rajiv Chandrasekaran spent a lot of time in the Green Zone, the heavily fortified quadrant of the Iraqi capital, home to the U.S. Embassy and the governmental apparatus then known as the Coalition Provisional Authority. It was, the Washington Post Baghdad bureau chief quickly realized, a strange place where Muslim cafeteria workers served pork chops and bacon flown in by Halliburton, and it was a kind of cocoon.
It was a whole motley assortment of Americans. There were some diplomats, there were some military officers, but there were also an awful lot of people who came in not because they possessed any great skill in the language of Arabic or experience in the Middle East, but they were recruited because of their political fidelity, their loyalty to the Bush administration and the Republican Party.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran wrote a book about that time and place called Imperial Life in the Emerald City. That book inspired a movie that opened this month, Green Zone, directed by Paul Greengrass, starring Matt Damon. If you've read the book or seen the movie, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, now associate editor of The Washington Post, with us here today in Studio 3A. Nice to see you.
Good to be here with you, Neil.
And when you were there and all this was playing out, did it seem to you cinematic?
You know, never in my wildest dreams did I think that a movie would come from all of this. I thought maybe late night moments as I was trying to process all of this, maybe it would yield in decades to come a MASH-like TV show, something darkly comedic, because it did feel absurd. I mean, it was a theater of the absurd unfolding in front of my eyes, that they would bring in, young Americans with no subject matter expertise, you know, a 24-year-old kid who hadn't worked in finance being assigned to reopen the stock exchange, a 21-year-old young man who hadn't even graduated from college, who boasted that his most meaningful job before going to Iraq was as an ice cream truck driver, being put to work with a team of Americans trying to rehabilitate the Ministry of the Interior. And I think your listeners know just what an important job purging the Interior Ministry of militiamen was way back then. That all of this stuff could unfold, the bacon in the cafeterias, the swimming pool, the disco, at a time when the Americans faced this very sort of narrow window of opportunity to reach out to the Iraqis, to try to establish some degree of public order and governance. And so looking back on all of it, you know, while I was there at the time, I thought, I didn't in a million years think it would come to this. But years pass, we start to process this information, and what we as journalists on the front line see eventually gets turned into long-form nonfiction that eventually gets read by folks in Hollywood, and they start to do their thing.
Well, don't spoil it. Don't tell us how it turned out, okay? Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. We'll begin with Mike, and Mike's calling us from Denver.
Yeah, hey, I saw the movie recently. I did not read the book, but I did see the movie, and it was, second to The Hurt Locker. It kind of captured for me the chaos, the insanity of the whole Iraq thing. I just thought what a mess it all was from watching it. I wonder how the movie differed from the book. I know that it took a lot of license and stuff like that, but would you say it was, honest to what you wrote in the book?
It's a very good question. The movie was inspired by the book. It wasn't based on the book. There is no Chief Warrant Officer Roy Miller character. That's the protagonist of the movie, played very, very brilliantly by Matt Damon. There is no individual figure as played by Greg Kinnear. My book was really a non-fictional account of that wacky world inside the Green Zone for the first 15 months. What the book did was it helped Paul Greengrass unlock an Iraq movie concept that was sort of banging around in his head at the time. And it helped Paul and Matt get a place for this movie. And so the Green Zone serves as the backdrop for what is a fictional action storyline, a thriller, if you will.
Did they talk to you about the script?
A little bit. They certainly sought some of my input when it came to how, the Green Zone should be depicted, et cetera. But they went off and did a lot of their own research on the issues of weapons of mass destruction and on how the military operated there, which was a little beyond what I was covering at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go next. This is Anne. Anne's calling us from Hutchison in Delaware.
Hi, thanks very much for having me on. Hi, Rajiv, it's Anne. How are you?
Oh, hi, Anne.
A friend of yours.
The comment I wanted to make, and I really enjoyed both Rajiv's book and the movie, although I think the movie took some artistic license with a staff sergeant doing the kinds of things Matt Damon did. But one thing that Rajiv and I have talked about before is that these young people who were pushed into these jobs for which they might not have had the subject matter expertise, in many cases, it wasn't really their fault. I mean, they were sort of shoved in there not quite knowing what to expect with virtually no training. And I sort of came in maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 months after that first wave of the young folks. And what I was struck by was sometimes they didn't know enough to know they shouldn't be asking certain things or doing certain things. And I found from time to time that some things got done that I never thought could have been done because of sort of normal protocols that you would go through in a reconstruction setting.
Well, that's, of course, totally unheard of for Hollywood to take artistic license. So.
And but the point that Anne, I think, was driving at is a good one to make, which is, you know, regardless of political affiliation, regardless of the length of their resumes, almost everybody who went out there in that first 15-month period went out there with the best of intentions. They all wanted to try to make Iraq work. The problem was, you know, do people who don't possess those necessary skills, are they the right people to send out there? In their defense, officials with the Bush administration would argue that they weren't really inundated with resumes from other sorts of people. However, there is, you know, what I found from my research was that there were a lot of qualified people whose applications were sort of thrown into the dustbin, and people were asked questions like, you know, do you support Roe versus Wade? Before they were allowed to go out there. And obviously, if you said you did, that was seen as a demerit.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Let's go next to Kevin. Kevin with us from El Sobrana in California.
Hi. I saw the movie. And a question I have is the lapses of intelligence that were depicted in the movie that resulted in the deaths of civilians and U.S. troops, so on, that as it was depicted in the movie, was that in your opinion, was that actually a common thing in Iraq? And I'm asking this because I'm thinking that if that was happening in Iraq, and that people were just willing to act on really flimsy intelligence, I'm wondering if that's happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan now too, especially with the drone killings.
Mm-hmm. Rajiv?
Well, the lack of good intelligence, the lack of actionable intelligence as depicted in the movie, I think is spot on with what really did occur there. I covered the UN weapons inspection process in the run-up to the ground invasion. And, you know, UN weapons inspectors would go into facilities that they were being told by the Americans potentially housed Scud missiles, and they were actually turned out to be chicken coops.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of it, I think, is spot on. Where the movie maybe goes one step beyond what we definitively know from reporting and the factual record is that, you know, it asserts that there was a sort of a clear conspiracy there. And I think that as people have sort of dug into this, the truth is somewhere, you know, on that continuum between gross negligence and, you know, outright malfeasance, and it's somewhere there. The movie, of course, because Hollywood has wanted to do this, makes it seem just a little bit more cut and dried than it might be in real life. With regard to Afghanistan, I mean, we still face some very significant intelligence challenges there, and you know, that's a subject for a whole separate discussion.
It is, yes.
But you know, I do think that as our troop presence increases there, one of the biggest challenges is trying to better understand the environment in which we're operating in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan.
Well, briefly, one of your last pieces from Afghanistan was about the situation in and around Marja, which you call a Marinistan, people operating under, their own rules at this point?
Well, the U.S. Marine Corps, which is operating in that part of southern Afghanistan, really is trying to actually take lessons that it felt it learned from operating in Iraq, in the western Anbar province, where it felt it had to, as the Marine Corps, sort of be creative, be inventive. And so they've gone out to Marja and neighboring parts of Helmand Province and just sought to sort of do things in their own way. And sometimes that's, you know, has ruffled some feathers with their colleagues in the Army and in the NATO headquarters in Kabul.
Because they want the Marines they want consistency, and they also want some of those troops to be available elsewhere.
Exactly. I mean, they see a much bigger challenge in the neighboring province, in Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city, the spiritual capital for the Taliban, home to nearly 1 million people. And you've got all these Marines sitting in the desert in Helmand province, and they're saying, well, those guys are doing counterinsurgency pretty well out there, but is Helmand really merit that many American service members? Should we not reallocate some of them? But the Marines have come with this condition saying, look, we need to have a contiguous battle space. We need to operate with our own helicopters, our own logistics units. And that means it's much harder for General Stanley McChrystal, the commander of all the forces in Afghanistan, to essentially move those troops around as he sees fit.
Well, not the first time the Marines and the Army have disputed over tactics or operational ideas. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, thank you very much. And I hope the book sells well in the aftermath of the movie.
Thank you very much, Neil. A pleasure to talk to you again.
The book is Imperial Life in the Emerald City, and the movie is Green Zone. And Rajiv Chandrasekaran is now associate editor of The Washington Post, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Tuesday, the day we read from your emails and web comments. Our conversation about and with first women inspired many of you to share your own stories of the run-up to and through the glass ceiling. Diane Chapman emailed from Jacksonville, Florida, "I was the first female construction lender in the Southeast in 1979. I worked for a national bank in Atlanta and would visit construction sites to ascertain how far along each project was and how much money could be disbursed to pay costs and subcontractors. I was constantly asked if I was a real estate agent, was I from the IRS, or just, who the H are you? My stock reply, I'm here to see if my bank can give you money this week. I was always welcome after that." Another listener wrote to tell us, "In the mid-1970s, I became the first woman staff announcer newscaster on the first all-news radio station in New York City. The management always insisted that until I came along, they'd not been able to really find a deserving woman. I always felt they weren't looking sincerely enough. I was hired when pressure was being brought on broadcasters to hire female talent. I believe they had to be forced into making that decision. I was smart and really good on air, but there were other good women too. Many men told me that it's so hard to find a woman with a voice suited to radio." That from Kate in Santa Barbara. And speaking of remarkable women, in December, we talked with Katie Spotts, at the time set to become the youngest person of any sex to row solo across an ocean. 70 days and 6 hours of rowing later, she did it. Katie Spotts is back on dry land, home in Ohio, and joins us now on the phone. Congratulations on your world record.
Thank you so much.
And the first thing people often want to know in these endurance tests, why on earth did you want to do it?
Well, I absolutely love to challenge myself, but more than that, I saw it as a great opportunity to raise awareness for a charity called Blue Planet Run. So my overall goal was to help raise funds and awareness for people who don't have access to safe drinking water.
And were there any moments along the way when you gave all that a second thought?
Of course. I mean, being alone at sea for over 2 months, there were moments I would have given anything to be back on land, but at the same, there were moments that I felt I would, you know, that the being at sea was the best place and to be. So there were many highs and lows during those days.
And can you tell us the most exhilarating moment?
As I was approaching the fourth way mark, I wasn't sure how to celebrate, but the decision was made for me when I started to see fins appear, and I had about a pod of 10 or 15 dolphins surrounding my boat. It was like they were giving their own personal show in the middle of the Atlantic for me, doing flips and tricks.
Huh.
The wildlife was amazing. I even had some fish followers for weeks along the bottom of the boat, had sea turtles and birds that would perch up on my solar panels. Sunsets and wildlife were always a good treat out there.
Did you see any people along the way?
I didn't see any people until 2 months into the journey. I was near the coast of South America and came across a Venezuelan fishing boat. They looked more surprised to see me than I did to see them. They just kind of shouted, "Loca, loca, loca," which means crazy, and I was on my way.
And then the moment when you finally approach shore.
Well, I started rowing in at night, so it started as a soft glow on the horizon, and then that turned into lights, and by morning I could start to see buildings and palm trees. But for an adventure like this, I didn't want to get too ahead of myself. The final bit is often the most difficult, so I wasn't really allowing myself to get excited until my feet were planted on solid ground once again.
And was your navigation was all right? Did you land where you expected to?
Well, on the coast of South America, there is a really strong current, and I knew this beforehand, but I had strong wind, so I had some really turbulent waters, 20-foot waves, and several times I thought my boat would capsize. I wanted to land in Cayenne, but if I approached Cayenne, I would likely need a tow for the last 10 miles, so I wanted to do it under my own steam and ended up rowing two countries over to ensure a safe arrival that I wouldn't need assistance of any sort for a tow.
Just two countries over, no big deal.
Just 10 more days, 400 miles, you know.
Katie, again, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for talking with us.
No problem.
Katie Spotts, 22 years old, just became the youngest person ever to row solo across an ocean and joined us on the phone from her home in Ohio. Before we go, a correction. While talking about whether textbooks lean left or right, I mentioned that the Tulsa race riots happened in 1923. I was wrong. The caller was right. The Tulsa riots occurred in 1921. Our thanks to Niels Hagen, Jr. for the correction. If you have comments, questions, or corrections for us, the best way to reach us is by email. The address is talk@npr.org. Please let us know where you're writing from and give us some help on how to pronounce your name. Talk of the Nation is produced by David Gura, John Asante, April Failing, Dahlia Martinez, and Barry Hardiman. Our editor is Scott Cameron. Drew Reynolds is our technical director, and our producer, executive producer, is Sue Goodwin. This is NPR News.